Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 here from a halfway hut in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Felisco.
And with us today is a writer for Vulture, New York Magazine, and the biggest Brooklyn Nets fan on Twitter, Bilge Aviri.
Wow, that's quite a claim there.
Well, there's no question you're the biggest in my timeline.
Probably the biggest Brooklyn Nets fan on film Twitter, probably.
Yes, that's probably
that seems
true.
Fair. That seems fair.
That's probably true. Yeah. I'm a Knicks fan, but it doesn't mean we can't be friends.
Yeah, at least for the next hour and a half.
That's right.
Here's a question for you, Bilge. Is this a bone of contention between you and David Sims as well, who I'm assuming is also a Knicks fan, or is he a Nets fan?
He is a Knicks fan.
Sims is a Knicks fan, but Sims is also... We talked about this. He actually also has gone to Nets games and stuff. Like, so he's you know, it's not that kind of, I mean, I don't know. I haven't had like a long talk with him about it. I'm sure we could come to blows if we wanted to.
Sims may be accommodating when it comes to the Nets sharing his city, but my sense is you want the Nets to just take over all five boroughs and the surrounding area. Or at least just somehow destroy the Knicks and go ahead.
So my history of becoming this is completely derailed the podcast already. especially in a, like a Jane Campion movie.
Can't help it.
I can't help myself. Basketball.
It's too unusual when we have a film Twitter person.
So my journey to to becoming like a diehard Nets fan actually begins with me hating the Knicks. Me hating the Knicks though, that was from the 90s because I was actually a Bulls fan because, I started watching basketball because I wanted to see Michael Jordan. I went to college in the tri-state area. So like basically all you had, and this was before, this was before the internet. So before League Pass or any of that crap. You basically had, the occasional nationally televised game. And then you had Knicks games. And then you had like on a fuzzy, like distant channel reception, you got Nets games.
That's right. That's where I watched the Nets too, by the way.
Yeah. I can't remember. I think it was like a channel 54 or something. I know what it was.
It was Sports Channel New York, but it was
bad reception.
Yes, it was horrible.
So you had to watch it through just like grain. It was like watching a Carl Theodore Dreyer movie and about as exciting, mind you, with the Nets back then. But I hated the Knicks. And so for the longest time, the Nets were kind of, and when I moved to New York, I was like, well, the Nets, I can tolerate the Nets. I still want the Knicks to lose. But then when they actually moved to Brooklyn, I was like, all right, well, now I'm a fan. Now I'm like a real fan. And I started going to games and stuff. And so
as a Knicks fan, I too hate the Knicks. So
I get along really well with Knicks fans generally. Yeah.
The Knicks are the most hateable franchise of all time. So I totally get it.
So I can only assume that Jane Campion's also a Knicks fan, but I really have no idea. But to pivot to Jane Campion, I do want to ask because I noticed on Twitter, Bilga, that you were talking about Jane Campion a little bit. I think it was Power of the Dog adjacent to some degree or another. And past and future guests, Karen Hahn, connected us. And I wanted to sort of just kind of from 30,000 feet ask you, when did you start watching her movies? Is she someone that you've been watching for a really long time, or how did she come into your life?
She is someone I've been watching for a very long time, since I was a kid. I'm trying to think of when I don't even remember the first Jane Campion film I saw. I mean, she was, she was one of these signature auteurs of my childhood. I mean, that's when she was coming up. Now, I started really young, like being a cinephile and being like a really, precocious and pretentious cinephile who, really wanted to see like the best of world cinema. And I had no time for like, I don't know, John Ford or Frank Capra movies or anything like that. Like I was just like deep dive into like old Cahiers du Cinéma lists and whatever was showing at Cannes and stuff like that. I'm pretty sure I'd seen An Angel at My Table before The Piano came out. Mm-hmm. And then The Piano came out while I was in college, and that was obviously just like a seismic event. Yeah. To be in college when The Piano came out was like a big deal. that was the movie everyone talked about. So she was kind of, she was always there as a filmmaker. And then I can't remember when I saw Sweetie, but it was not long after that. I was really excited by, the run up to Portrait of a Lady. Mm-hmm. And I loved The Portrait of a Lady. And I was kind of surprised at the time that people didn't quite groove with it.
They didn't like it.
Yeah.
It's weird.
I mean, I think some people just kind of held it at a distance. I'm very happy to see that film has kind of had a resurgence of interest. Yeah. One of the things I find interesting about Portrait of a Lady over the years, or have found interesting about it over the years, is, you talk to, I hate the gender essentialism into which I'm going here, but like you'll talk to men about the movie and they'll be like, I'm not sure. I just can't understand why she hooked up with John Malkovich. Right.
Right.
And that's that's kind of the central like turn in the movie. Mm-hmm. And you talk to women and they totally get it. You know?
Dangerous Liaisons thing too, right? Where there were people that were just like, he has a charisma and a sexuality to him that is compelling.
Yeah. But in, I mean, but in Dangerous Liaisons, at the very least, he's a seducer. Like he's like he's a great seducer, right? Whereas he's not quite that. He's like he's like vaguely pathetic in Portrait of a Lady. But what I love, but like that symbolizes, not symbolizes, but that represents one of the things I love about her movies, which is that there is like a mystery in the heart of all of them. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I've become more fascinated by this idea of films that don't quite resolve themselves. They're not quite closed loops. There's something missing. I've been beating this term that I came up with like 10 years ago or something called earworm cinema, right? Like this idea of a movie that has some typically essential element missing. Mm-hmm. So, because that's the way earworms work, right? Like the songs that that get stuck in your head. Apparently the reason they get stuck in your head is your brain can't quite remember it properly. And it's like, there's some element missing. And so your brain just goes into this loop, just playing it over and over again, trying to like figure out the song. And I love the idea that movies do that, you know, like movies that like have some key element missing. Sure. And then you just become obsessed with them and you just keep watching them because you're like, where is this? You know,
are there some quintessential examples of that?
Yeah, actually, a couple of films I've talked about in the context of earworm cinema. Well, The Shining, I think, is a great example of earworm cinema where they don't really explain what the hell is going on. You're just
certainly
kind of
not
at
with
loss.
That picture,
right? I mean, the book explains everything. The movie, like, just you know, they deleted the scene where they explained what happened. You know, I actually recently did this essay for Criterion on Citizen Kane, in which I made the very to my mind, the rather bold claim that Citizen Kane might actually be an example of earworm cinema, because there is something missing. There is a kind of through line to Kane that's missing. But there, it's not so much that it's not so much in Citizen Kane that it's missing. It's just that there are all these contradictory visions of the man, so you never get a full picture. Sure. There are a number of films like that where there's just some element that you would think would be there, and it's not, and it just freaks you out. Sometimes maybe without you even quite realizing, and then you just like watch the movie over and over again and you know, just never quite clicks.
I want to highlight something that you were just talking about, because I think it's worth unpacking a little bit, which is Jane Campion's depictions of masculinity, what it means to be a man, certainly within the universe of her films, which is fascinating to me. When you look at the obviously Holy Smoke, we'll get into that, where obviously there's very much a deconstruction of masculinity within that film. But, I watched a handful of her movies again in a lead up to this, some of which I hadn't seen before. I had not seen Bright Star before, which I really loved. But again, like a very interesting portrayal, Ben Whishaw's performance, a beautiful performance, but not sort of a particularly, I guess the men in her movies are strong, but in ways that don't seem strong, if that makes sense. What we assume to be sort of this strength in masculinity is just, there's just so many layers to the way that she does it. I mean, Power of the Dog obviously is another example of sort of these two men, three men that exist in that film and how drastically dissimilar they all are. I think it's fascinating. And I'm sort of curious as to whether or not that's one of the things that gravitated for you towards her movies.
I think she's really drawn to dreamers. Or to kind of, I interviewed her actually for the Telluride Film Festival program guide, and I still haven't seen the interview, so I don't know what part of it went. Like I did this long interview with her over the phone, and they just took it from there and edited it down, and you know, so I never actually saw the final version, so I don't know if this part is in there. But she called them lovers in my interview, like this idea. We were talking specifically about Power of the Dog, These like kind of creative souls who are often, often crushed by the world around them. Mm-hmm. And that goes for women and men in her films. But those are the types of people that she's interested in. But it's interesting, like for women, it manifests itself in different ways than it does for men in her films.
Absolutely.
And when you look at it in that way, that makes some of the things that people find baffling about some of these films, particularly Holy Smoke, interesting because it makes it more compelling and perhaps understandable because, you know, like Keitel's character turns out to be one of those people. Like these two people find each other because they have this weird connection. And but if you looked at it like on the page, you'd ask yourself, well, how the hell do these two get together, you know? I don't know if I've answered your question, but that's kind of the thing that I think she sort of is drawn towards. Which then becomes a crisis of masculinity, of course. I mean, Power of the Dog is all about that. Mm-hmm. And I think she's also fascinated by characters who are in some way incapable of being anybody but themselves.
For sure.
Which I think is one of the fascinating things about Power of the Dog, because you have Benedict Cumberbatch's character who is, I mean, this, I guess it's in theaters. A lot of people know. Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen it,
but you can go right ahead.
All right.
Doesn't bother me at all.
It goes up on Netflix this weekend, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. December 1st, I believe. You have, Benedict Cumberbatch's character who is, you know, who's obviously dealing with all sorts of repressed, you know,
gender roles.
Yeah. Yes. Things. And has kind of glommed onto this kind of cowboy myth, cowboy ethos, which of course was passed down to him from another guy who was dealing with the same stuff. Bronco Henry? Was it Bronco Henry?
Yep.
So there's like this whole tradition of, you know, repressed homosexuality that he's coming from. But then you have Cody Smith McPhee's character who is incapable of being anything but himself. Like is just, and it's, it, you can tell, it drives Cumberbatch crazy, you know, because at first you think he hates him for who he is compared to who Cumberbatch is. And there's obviously some of that. But then slowly you realize he hates him for the fact that he doesn't change. He hates him for the fact, and it's almost like he's trying to, you know, when he kind of brings him under his wing, he's trying to sort of lead him down this path of becoming more of, you know, a quote unquote man. Mm-hmm. And Cody Smith McPhee he's not going to do it. He's going to do it in his own way. Yeah.
You can see it in the Sam Neill Harvey Keitel dynamic as well in the piano where you're seeing sort of Harvey Keitel is being himself, right? Like there is no one. And I would also Ada Holly Hunter's character also very similarly, dedicated to being the person that they want to be. Sam Neill is dealing with repression, dealing with sort of social norms and the things that he's supposed to be doing versus what he wants to be doing. And I think Holy Smoke is a perfect example of this as well, right? I mean, it's all about deprogramming and this idea of like the person that you're supposed to be or what your family wants you to be. But it's also like Holy Smoke is a very interesting movie, a movie that I really kind of didn't know much about. I don't know if you knew anything about it, Kenny, going into it either.
No, hardly anything.
Yeah. So to me, first of all, in my brain,
which is an interesting way to go into this movie.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yes.
You know, because this movie is one thing for the first 30 minutes and then becomes something very different.
I love that about it. I also just want to just for a quick second talk about the way Jane Campion's movies have been, embraced or lack thereof, right? Like this movie was not embraced at all. Holy Smoke, 46% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 47 from audiences. A movie that I think was grossly sort of discarded. I would say, Bright Star didn't really make much of an impact, even though it's a really beautiful movie. I also feel like Portrait of a Lady at the time didn't really get its moment. Do you think that there's something with the type of movies she makes? Do you think it's the way they're made? What is it, do you think, that makes it so that her films take time for people to come around to them?
Well, I think it's very simple. First of all, she's an incredibly idiosyncratic director. Idiosyncratic can be kind of a bullshit word sometimes, you know. she's a very distinctive filmmaker. And to the culture's credit, The Piano is one of the strangest films she's ever made.
Yeah.
And one of the strangest films, you know, to ever be like nominated for a Best Picture and become like a award season
like three
juggernaut.
Big awards.
You know? Yeah. I mean, and it's so fun because that's the year that like, I mean, that was the year of Schindler's List, right? Yeah. And so it was never going to win the big award, but enough people saw it as a contender that there was even like a bit of a like Oppo campaign against her. No, this was actually this was a really dark moment in film criticism when Michael Medved. Michael Medved, not exactly a tribune of the film critical establishment, but he actually, he was a big Schindler's List fan. And I guess didn't care for The Piano very much. But, you know, it's like at the time of The Piano, Jane Campion actually, I don't know how much you know about her life. She actually, she gave birth to a baby that died after 12 days. And I don't know if it was a case where she knew it was going to happen, but, you know, it was, I mean, incredibly tragic thing. And at one point, Michael Medved actually accused her of kind of using that to gain sympathy votes in the Oscar race, which she certainly did not do. You know, anybody that talked about Schindler, anybody that said anything remotely negative about Schindler's List got piled on at the time. So, but, you know, I mean, these were the dark days of, you know, Harvey Weinstein Oscar campaigns and things like that. So, but the idea that The Piano was like such an acclaimed film that it was seen as a runner-up only to Schindler's List at the Oscars is incredible. When you see the movie, it's incredible. But it's weird because people embrace that. People embraced her. And this thing that happens with these types of films is that they then get really psyched for the next one.
Right.
But they have this idea that the next one is somehow going to be more. And to be, you know, to be fair, she did adapt a Henry James novel. So, you know, that I'm sure fed into it. But people really thought that that was going to be like. Yeah, I mean, I love Merchant Ivory, but back then Merchant Ivory had become kind of a code word for, you know, boring, staid, you know, cinema of tradition, which Merchant Ivory totally isn't. Like Merchant Ivory, like, we can have a whole other conversation about them. But I think people thought that kind of that's what it was going to be, just like a kick-ass period picture or something. And it wasn't. It was a totally strange. I mean, it's still in some ways her most traditional movie, but still totally crazy film. I do think that each of these films has had a different reception. So I don't think it's been kind of a consistent. Also, there's enough time between her films that it's not like people are like, oh, Jane Campion is this type of director. And there she goes again. I don't think it's like that. I think it's just that she makes these really idiosyncratic films. And every time it comes out, this idea that I wrote something about this not long ago, but, you know, Whit Stillman on another film podcast, the Cows in the Field podcast, had this great idea, this great term that he said, you know, the not normalness of films, like when they first come out, really sort of kind of turns people off. And then it's only like a few years later that they're suddenly able to kind of really actually rewatch these movies, and people are able to kind of understand that some movies are strange, and that's actually a good thing. But when they're coming out in the heat of the Oscar race, or they're coming out and you're kind of seeing them in the context of the careers of the people involved. I mean, this is Kate Winslet 2 years after Titanic, right?
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of other stuff. And it's just Kate, and she's naked, you know, and it's Harvey Keitel, and you know, he was in The Piano. It's like there's all this stuff becomes part of the discourse. This is a
weird movie, and I say that in a positive way, but it is a strange film.
Oh yeah.
I mean, to Kenny's point, this movie starts, I was like, okay, I think I'm on this movie's wavelength. I think I sort of understand what it's doing. And then she really pulls the rug out from underneath you, so much so that it's quite discombobulating. And I did find myself going like, genuinely have no idea where this movie's going now, which is obviously exhilarating and exciting, but I imagine for some people it's not. For some people it's, I have preconceived notions coming into this film, and if it's not meeting them, then I'm not interested.
I also want to kind of just take half a step back to what Bill was saying, because I think that there's, you know, obviously a societal issue and a question here with how these movies are received, and particularly when you have a filmmaker like Jane Campion who didn't have much of a footprint in America before The Piano, and The Piano comes out and is, it's allowed to kind of grow organically and grow small and be a word of mouth hit. and I think exceed most people's expectations when they actually sat down in the theater. She has this giant target on her back after that. Now, I mean, I'm tempted to say something glib, which is like, well, her reward is that she got to have a career, because so many female filmmakers who make an incredible film that don't reach the heights of this film don't even get to have a career. You know, Bilge, you know, we've done 200 of these and we've probably seen at least a dozen movies by female filmmakers that we love. And then the follow-up question is, now why haven't they made more? Yeah. So,
and Kimberly Pierce being maybe one of the biggest ones that with Boys Don't Cry.
Like, yeah, Kimberly Pierce is you know, a great example, but there's so many of them.
Yep.
And so there is that aspect of it. Now, I think, frankly, the issue with Holy Smoke is not so much that people saw it and didn't like it. It's that the critics had their knives out because it was 1999 and we had our knives out for people like her. And a lot of people didn't see it. And I think that's more or less the story of that movie until this podcast when we reclaim it.
But I mean, I absolutely agree with you, Kenny, because I remember when this film came out, you know, Bilge, you talked about how it was 2 years after Titanic, right? Everyone was like, what is Leo and Kate going to do after Titanic? What are their follow-up movies? And her follow-up for a few years post-Titanic is fascinating, but also kind of littered with a bunch of movies that sort of exist and kind of don't exist. Your Quills and your Life of David Gales and movies that are just sort of like
this year too, which we haven't done yet.
And Hideous Kinky and this one have like weird resonances,
similarities,
to the point where sometimes I'll before my recent research, I was like, which one was Hideous Kinky and which one was Holy Smoke? Like,
right, but it is. I totally agree with you, Kenny. This movie just sort of didn't make much of a footprint. I mean, I want to give just a really quick context for our listeners in terms of a synopsis, which is, while on a journey of discovery in exotic India, beautiful young Ruth, played by Kate Winslet, falls under the influence of a charismatic religious guru. Her desperate parents then hire PJ Waters, played by Harvey Keitel, a macho culty programmer who confronts Ruth in a remote desert hideaway. But PJ quickly learns that he's met his match in the sexy, intelligent, and iron-willed Ruth. It opened on December 3rd, 1999, against Toy Story 2, The World Is Not Enough, End of Days, Sleepy Hollow, and The Bone Collector. So, like, this is, you know what I mean? Like, look at that and tell me that this film's ever going to have a chance to find an audience.
And that was, I believe, like a week-long qualifying run too. Like it wasn't like a what, because it wound up, I think, being like a January release. You know, I mean, yes. this was one of these, you know, they had to qualify it, show it to critics and stuff. And I think some critics, I heard somewhere, I don't remember this. I wasn't a member of any critics organization at the time, but I think Kate Winslet actually did well in like critics awards. Like, I think she
did win a couple critics circles for sure. Yeah. It wasn't like the movie didn't have any impact. I mean, I think that it goes without saying to some degree that anything Jane Campion does after The Piano is going to get people talking
absolutely,
in some way or another.
Absolutely. And these critics were aware of her work. Like, people knew who she was in those circles, people who knew who she was before The Piano. Mm-hmm. But I will say, I mean, look, Holy Smoke is not a perfect movie by any stretch of the imagination. And sure. One of the things watching it again, you know, I'm struck by how little sense it makes, like, from scene to scene to scene. And there's so many he's like this great cult deprogrammer, but like at the first sign of any kind of resistance for her, he just like completely evaporates.
Shit.
Right. And which then you'd say, okay, well, okay, maybe it's just the idea is that this is the first time a woman has even like, resisted him. Mm-hmm. But then you're like, well, that's not, that seems like a terrible thing to say about women for Jane Campion. Yeah. I'm not sure that was her point. So maybe he's just kind of he's never, you know, had that kind of resistance just as a person. But then his girlfriend shows up and it's Pam Grier. Yeah. And you're just like, all right, well, that doesn't entirely make sense.
Yeah, that was
But that's, at the same time, that's kind of what makes the film great. That's why you never know where it's going, because it actually doesn't, like, no scene actually makes sense. Like, the next scene never makes sense from what you've just seen. And that makes it kind of delightful. Like, every
when
scene
Pam
is delightful.
Grier showed up, I was just like, Wow.
I'm just like, all right, sure. Why not? You know, I mean, by that point, you've already seen so much, but like, that's one of the things I love about the movie. It's like, if she had kind of gone through and made the script make more sense and kind of, you know, dotted her I's and crossed her T's in terms of like character development and everything, it wouldn't be nearly as entertaining, but it probably would have been a little more of a, you know, like a consistent experience watching it, maybe.
Well,
you know,
I think that one of the things that was thrown at this film, at least in the research that I'd done by critics, right, which is, and to be perfectly honest, Kate and her sister, Anna, I believe, who wrote it together, both talked about how they wanted these characters to be very articulate and for these to be sort of a battle of wills, a battle of wits, in terms of, you know, a battle of sexes, if you will. And I think a lot of people felt like it's a lot of scenes between the two of them kind of mind fucking each other, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Like, I don't know what the problem is there, but I understand that some people might find that, I don't know, less like when there's just scenes of the two of them and she's just literally breaking him down and his masculinity down, I'm just like, this is good shit. Like, it made me think of the scene in Eyes Wide Shut when Nicole Kidman gives that big speech that essentially like blows his mind and sends him on this whole journey. Like, I don't know. I think that's great, but what did you guys think?
Well, Eyes Wide Shut, another film that you know, that didn't exactly
bit of a
resonate
grower.
With Chris. Yeah. Bit of a grower. Yeah. Yeah.
I think, you know, look, it maybe it's trite, but I think it's pretty obvious what's going on here. The cult is masculinity. The cult is American masculinity, actually. Yeah. There's a reason the first shot you see of him is cowboy boots with fucking Neil Diamond playing. And I think that's specifically what Jane Campion.
It's a great entrance,
It's fucking awesome. And in a worse movie about the really great cowboy deprogrammer, you know, you would have just gone with it and you wouldn't have thought that hard. And I think that what happened was I was like, oh great, it's the Neil Diamond cult deprogrammer movie, this will be a hoot, and then had my entire, you know, identity challenged, and that was difficult for me, but I think that's think that's what was happening over the course of this movie. My issue is more with the tactics. My issue is more with the I think Bill is saying this, I don't really exactly understand what happened. I know where we started, I know where we ended. I know what I saw, but I don't exactly understand why the characters acted the way they acted throughout the course of the film. But that's
specifically Harvey, more so him.
Whoa,
I would say
really
than, okay. Ruth, I mean, as well,
specifically Harvey, but I don't know what she said or did to get him to do anything.
That I agree.
In particular, and I, in the absence of something that I can really kind of grasp onto, it does kind of slip, you know, it's kind of slippery slope its way into some younger women, older men tropes that,
he does fall in love with her very quickly, it feels like.
And she very much thinks the reason is because she's a young, attractive woman. At some point, she says something to the effect of, do you love me or do you love my breasts?
Yeah.
Right? So,
does he say her breasts? He said, in this moment, it's your breasts.
Yeah, right. He's honest. That is progress, actually, for a modern man. But so I actually really kind of love the movie as a finished product, as a, you know, from a 30,000 foot view. But in the moment, I was very confused, and it didn't necessarily have that earworm quality to me where I'm trying to figure it out. But
I don't disagree.
I think, you know, it's very arresting what happens when we wind up. So I think it's, you know.
Well, I think I texted you when I was about halfway through it, Kenny, and I was like, this movie's really weird, but it's very compelling.
Yeah.
Like you can't, like, you're not bored at any point, despite the fact that, to your point, and I agree with you, Kenny, on a plotting or a character level, I did find myself wondering why these turns were happening. But I will also say, and this is going to seem like a cheat, and I certainly don't mean it to, but like, these are two pretty unstable people. So there is maybe more so Ruth than PJ, depending on how you look at it. But I did sort of get the impression that these are really fragile people that have essentially locked themselves in a hut in the outback. Weird shit's going to go on that I'm not entirely convinced needs to be all that, you know, but motivated. But yes, Bilga?
I was going to say, at the same time, though, they've got it more together than anyone else around them. I mean, the thing that I'm always struck by is because you see, you know, the film opens in, if I remember correctly, it opens in India. Mm-hmm. And then it cuts back to Australia. Mm-hmm. And then you see her family and you're like, well, this is why this woman is searching for something better in her life. You know, like these people are ridiculous. And I mean, she, you know, Campion plays it up for comedy and she continues to play it up for comedy, but then every once in a while, someone will do something awful, right? I mean, her dad is this hilarious. And I think that's like a very Australian character, like the guy just like hanging out in his Speedo and the tan, yeah. You know, and the bad toupee and, you know, just playing golf all day long. And he's like, you know, he's a comic character, but, you know, he's also just a complete shithead, you know.
Total shithead. Realize. All I could think though was, wow, this guy's figured it out. this guy's got it made. How is he pulling this off?
And then, you know, obviously you have like the sister-in-law and all these other. I mean, the brother, the gay brother, and his not husband, but at that point it wouldn't have been a husband, but
lover, I guess.
You know, and his partner are. Mm-hmm. You know, they seem kind of cool, but they're also very much, they've bought in on this whole family, you know, deprogramming thing. And I love how she keeps cutting back to them, mm-hmm. even in moments where we don't really need to know what they're doing. And then she'll just cut to like some delightful little like moment of craziness and then just go back to everything, which creates this atmosphere of a world in which anything can happen and a world in which you're never quite sure tonally where you are. Am I watching something that's hilarious or am I watching something that's tragic or, you know, like, I mean, people get punched in the face and stuff and there's a rape attempt. I mean, there are all sorts of terrible things happening in this movie, but she's not afraid to kind of still sort of, you know, keep cutting back to comic moments. Mm-hmm. She doesn't necessarily play that stuff for comedy, but she's unafraid to kind of do something dark and then followed up with something just ridiculous. There's an interesting point
that, you know, to be made about that particular idea, which is when I first moved out to LA, I worked on the show Intervention, and interventions in general are kind of fascinating because it doesn't really matter who is in your family or who are your friends. At that moment, they have complete control over. Right. And a lot of the times these people are fucking buffoons. And a lot of the time people are just there because they're being asked to be there and they don't even really understand the extent of the issue. And a lot of the times I think they're just there to exert their superiority over you.
Sure.
Right. You're the one with the problem. I'm the one telling you to get help or you can get out of my life. There's this moment in the movie where these dopes circle her. In a, you know, Australian outback desert wasteland Mad Max, you know, in 20 years situation, and just keep kind of like circling around her, moving with her, trying not to touch her, looking like the biggest bunch of fools of all time and not understand. Like, she goes to hug, I think it's her brother, right? She goes to hug one of them and basically like begs him to like, you know, be normal for a second and not put her into this situation. Cause like, I think part of what we recognize over the course of the movie is she wasn't really in a cult. So, then that's what I'm saying. Like, these idiots have this power over her based on a hunch that her mom has.
Yep.
And I think that that's a really, I think it's important to show just how unreliable these people are. I think The Sopranos, if you remember, did it really well with Christopher's intervention too, where you have, of all people, Paulie Walnuts spitting in his face and saying, "You better stop with you're smacking and you." It's ludicrous. But like, you know, again, I saw a lot of interventions work, so it goes both ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something really interesting to Ruth's character in the sense of what, first of all, what you're talking about, Kenny, and the misinterpretation of youth. The misinterpretation of her naivete, if that's the right word. I think that There's a quote here that Jane Campion said, Ruth is beautiful and intelligent. She's also young. That was a real point of entry for the character. I believe youth tends to make people, it made me anyway, very dogmatic and very brave. Young people keep us honest. They're also so intolerant of anything hypocritical. You hear it from your kids all the time. The one thing they can't tolerate is hypocrisy, which also gives them problems with the contradictory or paradoxical nature of life. Anything that has a kind of overlapping or complex quality to it. I think there's something really interesting to that.
To just describe that, like, Twitter.
Right? Well, yeah. Yeah. But like, I love the fact that they saw Ruth as this brave person, right? That there was this fortitude to her, and that everyone else thinks she's crazy for that. And I think that that's, I mean, Kenny, you have kids. I'm assuming, Bilga, you have kids. Like, I think that you must see that sort of honesty and that frustration with hypocrisy.
You hate hypocrisy. That's every day we get called, you know, called to task for the, we get court-martialed for all the hypocrisy in our marriage and family, sure, and house. But yeah.
But do you think that, like, that's just a rite of passage, that like you become jaded and you're just like, fuck it at a certain point? I don't know.
Well, I think because she's somebody who has always made movies about the messiness of life.
Yeah.
I think that that's something that she, like, in order to be able to make movies about the messiness of life, you have to recognize the messiness of life. So I'm sure that Jane Campion as a person, I don't know her or anything like that, but I'm sure she's somebody who has struggled with all of these things at various points in her life. Like the idea of kind of.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You know, confidence and righteousness and being dogmatic about certain things while recognizing that the world is not that way. And also, I mean, look, a filmmaker, a director has to, you know, like they are the ultimate villain, right? I mean, to get anything done, a director has to kind of coax and cajole and in certain ways, you know, be hypocritical or pull things out of people that, I mean, you know, again, I don't know much about her as an actual like on-set director, but sure. You know, like a filmmaker is the biggest hypocrite in the world, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like they fix their camera on you and they talk to you to try and get some kind of emotion out of you. And as soon as that's done, they're like, all right, move it on. Next person, you know? Yeah. And for each, and for each actor, I'm sure they have different ways of dealing with them. And, you know, I mean, film sets are just like the worst hierarchies ever. So, you know, I'm sure she's somebody who has had to deal with all of this stuff. And as a parent too, I mean, you know, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the kind of the stridency of youth, but also the openness of youth.
Yeah.
Right. And what's interesting about Keitel's character is he kind of reconnects with that. I mean, he's somebody who's like, you know, like his hair is clearly painted. I mean, the idea is he is middle-aged and probably sort of trying to hang on to whatever kind of youth he has in a superficial way. But in some ways he, you know, I mean, this sounds like such a cliche, especially with like, you know, relationships between younger women and older men, where, you know, I'm sure she makes him feel young again. But in some way that actually liberates him to actually have like a normal, quote unquote, normal life with his, you know, with his girlfriend.
Well, that makes me think of two things. The first is, one of the best scenes in the film is when I think she tries to teach him how to kiss. again, which comes back to what you were saying about youth. This idea that like he's so set in his ways as to what he thinks a sexual relationship is supposed to be, or at the very least, what dynamics between men and women are supposed to be. And she literally has to train him to connect with her, something that I'm assuming the women in his life have not done previous. But then I would also say, in terms of, I know we're jumping all over the place in terms of the plot, but at the end of this movie, you get the distinct impression that he would drop everything again just to be with Kate.
Oh, yeah. So he basically says it in that letter.
Yeah,
he's just like, where do you want me? When, like, just tell me when and where and I'll be here. So like, I don't know that he's necessarily really gotten over her.
That's true.
But I know what you're saying. I think that there's something, you know, Kenny, you talked about PJ's introduction, which is, you know, cowboy boots, this leather jacket, you know, this. And I love that that's how we meet him. And at the end of the movie, he's wearing a dress and lipstick, and he's basically just a broken, like, husk of a man.
Yeah, and he's assuming the subordinate position in their cuddle. And I think that there's a lot to, I know that there's a lot to that. You know, he is the one who needs to be taken care of at that point. He is the one who needs to be rescued. He's the one who's been completely broken down and deprogrammed. I mean, this is, you know. Amazing.
And dominated. I mean, he becomes a sub, you know, like, I mean, there's that great scene at the bar where, what she says, she says she wants to have a smoke, and he says, no, you shouldn't have a smoke. And she's like, I think I'd like to have one. And it's such a great sort of, she's got him eating out of the palm of her hand at this point.
Well, it's amazing that, like, I would argue, I'm not convinced he ever really had any sense of control over her. Like, there's something, their first scenes together, you get the impression that, like, he's giving rules and he's putting sort of guardrails on what she can and can't do. But, I mean, she's spelling out help in stones. I mean, she's basically figuring out ways to kind of communicate outside of this little weird hut that he's created. And I would argue that, you know, I think he wants to sleep with her from the second that he meets her. Like, I don't know that... I don't know how he's deprogrammed in the past and whether or not this is a new thing for him or not. But that scene the next morning after they've had sex in the kitchen, and he's just, you can tell that he, like, something's happened to him and she's sort of broken through, and she's so dismissive of him and how much it breaks his heart that she doesn't feel the way he feels almost immediately. I mean, it's, Harvey's really good in this movie.
He's great. I mean, it's in some ways, he's probably the only person who could have played this part and made it compelling in that way. Because, I mean, look, the guy's a shitty deprogrammer. He's supposedly the best cult deprogrammer in the world that they, like, spent all this money on. And he sucks. Like, he's just not good at it at all. Yeah.
I'm gonna give him a little leeway in that they say he's the best, but this fucking family could
That's true.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, no, it is true. Like, they could have found him anywhere. But it is interesting, though, that, I mean, he's presented as kind of the guy who's, you know, like, who knows what he's doing.
He presents himself that way, for sure.
Yeah. But I do think that there is, like, she recognizes in him something, like, that scene, because that scene you talked about where they circle her, right, outside, and then that basically leads to her kind of walking to him. And I can't help but think that at that moment, and I don't think the cutting does this, but like, just thinking about it, I can't help but think in that moment that at that point she recognizes in him, this is my only way out of this is through that guy. So I don't think, because it also never quite made sense to me that she would just be like, all right, fine, let's do this, you know, instead of just, like, breaking out into a run or something, you know? Yeah. It just seemed like a very odd moment. But then I realized, oh, I think she realizes that, like, he's going to be able to get her out of this situation.
Yeah, the best way I can describe it is there's a swagger to him at the beginning and a confidence to him at the beginning that certainly feels like, I think Kenny and I both were like, yeah, this guy will get it done. I mean, it's a deprogramming movie, and it feels like this
he's the wolf.
He's the wolf.
And that's, I think, you know, You forget who? What was his name in Reservoir Dogs? I forgot. Mr.
One of the Colors.
Mr. One of the Colors.
Sure.
One of the Colors. You forget that he played like kind of the opposite of that in that movie, you know, mm-hmm. but he's the wolf. Like that's who he's the wolf, he's forever the wolf. And I think any idea that this guy wouldn't go into a situation and solve it within, you know, three moves was kind of a shock to begin with. That's part of why I think he was such a great casting choice.
And he was the wolf. I mean, he was the wolf after The Piano, right? Because Piano is 93 and Pulp Fiction is 94. So, you know, it's like, it's weird because he's kind of, you know, he embodies all his parts. That's one of the things I like about Keitel, even though he's an incredibly versatile actor. You know, when he's used the right way, he is in some ways used almost like a movie star in that he kind of embodies everybody he's already played. Because by this point, I mean, this is the 90s. This is the era of Tarantino movies he's done. This is the era of The Piano. This is the era of Bad Lieutenant. When he has like a Bad Lieutenant moment when the sister-in-law goes down on him, which is like, I mean, he's much more gentle than he is in Bad Lieutenant, but it's kind of like, but that's such a kind of, I was like, all right, that's, I remember that Harvey Keitel, you know, like, so he kind of, you know, he's like Michael Douglas. You know how Michael Douglas with each movie is playing just like a collection of all the previous Michael Douglas roles? That's kind of what Keitel is doing here.
That's we bemoan a lot of things that we've lost on this podcast, but losing the hyper specific urban male character actor. Mm-hmm. Is one of our great losses. Like I mean, not to go on too much of a tangent, but like I keep trying to write this role for a modern Joe Pesci, and it keeps coming back that guy doesn't exist. Like, you, where are you gonna? What, no one is there. That doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah. Oh, Kenny's gonna go to do with his dog. I'll just say that Harvey Keitel has had and continues to have a fascinating career. I love that he's now a Wes Anderson player, which I think is amazing. Like, he's, you know, he has range. Sorry, Kenny?
He's 80.
Yeah, well, yeah. Looks great. Shirtless in the Grand Budapest Hotel. He still looks like he can kick people's ass. But yeah, I mean, he's just, I don't know that we ever fully embraced. It felt like he was, I don't want to say he's a punchline because that's not fair, but there was a lot of sort of that in the 90s, Bad Lieutenant, Harvey Keitel seemingly showing us his genitals a fair amount. There was like there was just stuff going on.
The other thing about these guys that I'm talking about, Keitel, Pesci, Walken, they always kind of verged on self-parody.
Correct.
Right? Yeah. And they were always kind of these, you know, they were people who got lampooned a lot, people got impersonated a lot. And that was part of the charm because they were certainly in on the joke. It's another thing I just don't think people are down to do anymore. I think ever since Wahlberg got made fun of on SNL, you know, go, you know, say hello to your mother. Everyone's so afraid of showing showing anything outside of the movie for smooth star persona. Yeah.
You know who I'm thinking of though is that kind of connects to this. Please. Is a John Bernthal.
Oh, he's awesome. Right.
John Bernthal is kind of continuing that tradition.
He was Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, there's actually another guy, another actor who actually who's a friend of mine who I did some movies with years ago, who is now actually like getting a profile. It's taken him a while, but Louis Conselmi, who's in he's on Billions. He's in The Irishman. He's actually now in Killers of the Flower Moon too. Oh, cool. But he's in The Irishman. He's the guy, he's the assassin in the car with the fish.
And
he's a very distinctive face. And he's a great actor. He's a great theater actor too, but he kind of has that like, you know, urban character actor quality, which is funny because when I knew him, he was, I mean, he's such a striking looking person, but when he was young, you're like, oh, this guy's going to go out for like leading man roles. And now he's gotten a little older. I mean, he's younger than me, but now you're like, oh, that's the part he should be doing. Like these kind of tough guy character actor parts, you know?
Well, and I wonder, this also taps into something as well that I feel like, that it feels like Hollywood doesn't like people with faces anymore, like with interesting looks, people that feel so specifically them. It's so disappointing. You know what I mean? We talk all the time about all the
Chris's,
and women. Right? And it's just, yeah. it's a real bummer that there's just a lack of specificity now, which I think is unfortunate.
Well, I mean, I think because I think part of it is that kind of face. I mean, those kinds of faces. I think you really need a director of vision to pull that off. And that's not where sort of the modern A-list directors' strengths lie generally. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are obviously filmmakers who can do this. I mean, Scorsese still casts great faces.
Sure.
Campion certainly casts great faces. Well, Terrence Malick was always a great face caster, you know? that sounds gross. Great face caster.
But I think
this is a great conversation. Because you know who's got the face, but they decided to make him a babe? It's fucking Adam Driver.
Well, I was just
that guy explodes with this face and all the things we can do with him, and now he's just like the hunk.
I don't know that it needs to be mutually exclusive. I guess
it doesn't. Point. Like it doesn't.
I think that Carrie Whitmer just had an article about Gucci and the noses in Gucci, yeah. and how there's just a lot of noses. And I do think that Ridley's one of those people who still kind of casts faces from time to time.
I want to make it clear: it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. Yeah. I just don't think they're casting Adam Driver in roles that wouldn't, you know, the next guy in line wouldn't be a Brad Pitt. It's had nothing to do with the way he looks anymore, which is kind of disappointing. Like, I mean, of course, throughout the history of film, you have all these people with bizarre, interesting looks who've been leading men. And that's fun in its own way. But it's really the specificity of it is relevant what a person looks like, mm-hmm. right? There's this idea that, you know, it doesn't matter, but it does matter. It is relevant, and you can use that in your storytelling.
It's the most important thing. I think part of what happens is when we think about, when we talk about what people look like, there's this assumption that means that they have to look great.
Right.
And I would venture, I mean, look, you guys would know better than I would what it's like out in Hollywood, but I think there is this obsession with, you know, just like, you know, smooth faces, perfect
safety.
Bodies, all that
the
stuff,
safety.
You know, and it is kind of a probably that, and plus the fact that, you know, I mean, I think I from what I understand of how a lot of directors operate nowadays, you know, there's never a part of the process where you're trying to get the movie made, where you get to just like show faces or anything like that, because so much of it is like pre-visualization of action scenes if you're that kind of filmmaker. But then a lot of it is just like being in the room and, you know, pitching the whole thing. Like at what point in the pitch meeting and you say, and this dude has the most amazing face you've ever seen. Like that's just not a thing that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
So you know who has great faces? Every single person on Succession.
I don't watch Succession, but I'm sure they do.
They got the faces.
Yeah. I will say though.
Yeah. Sorry, you don't watch it, Billy? Oh,
I'm bad with TV. There are only a couple of things I can find time to watch. And,
no,
I
hear you.
And
there's so much to watch.
There's so much to watch.
Between bad basketball and like Curb Your Enthusiasm.
I mean, basketball my dance is card a time is book.
Oh yeah, I also watch. Yeah, I'm also watching like Turkish soccer, which is, you know.
Sure.
Let's not talk about that.
But I agree with what you're saying, Kenny. That everyone has great faces on Succession. I also think that, and you mentioned this, Bilge, but like Power of the Dog is another one where it's like everyone's got really great faces in that movie.
Yeah.
Well, Cumberbatch is the one I was thinking of, because Cumberbatch explodes, and you're like, I have never seen a guy
looks like him. Yeah. I agree.
And now he's just kind of, you know, been casting all these. I haven't seen Power of the Dog. I don't know the way they
I think you're going to like him. I think
that's the best performance he's ever given.
He's amazing.
I love him.
And he's had a good year. Like, that's the thing. Cumberbatch had that. He had Power of the Dog, obviously. He's got this other movie, like, out literally right now that I haven't seen about Gats. Right?
Lewis Wan, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And then he got the Courier earlier this year, which was a Sundance title from last year, but came out this year. Mm-hmm. This was actually in last year's Oscar race because of the way they extended it into this year. But the one about the Abu Ghraib prisoner, I'm blanking on the. I'm blanking on the title. And he was actually very good in all these.
And he's about to have Spider-Man.
Yeah, well, of course. Of course. look, it's so funny because I have to give him so much credit, though, because he is cranking out interesting movies, interesting parts. They're not always great, but he's actually doing the work while also being Doctor Strange, which a lot of these other guys are not doing.
That means a lot coming from Mark Ruffalo.
It's true.
I was at the Gotham Awards with Mark. No, I wasn't with Mark Ruffalo, but at one point he got on, and I was like, "Oh, actually, our hair is like falling the exact same way." I wonder if somebody will.
For those of you who are listening and not watching, Bill is a dead ringer for Mark Ruffalo. And I can't believe he gave me the perfect opening.
I want to ask a question about. About Kate Winslet in this film and sort of about Kate Winslet in terms of her career, I guess, because it does feel like an interesting moment in her career. I would argue that I feel like post-Titanic, her career, for me anyway, didn't really take off until Eternal Sunshine. And I know that that's, you know, a few years later, but like she does movies obviously between Titanic and Eternal Sunshine. And there's about 5 years in between those films, I believe 5 or 6 years, but it's just sort of, it feels like she's just not sure about how big a star she wants to be perhaps. And I think that there's something really interesting about her and Harvey Keitel working together in this film, because it does feel like Harvey Keitel is a guy who found a lane for himself, right? Like he does the movies he wants to do. And I don't know. I'm curious as to, I thought she was very good in this movie. And by the way, I thought she was good before Titanic. I love her in Sense of Sensibility. I love her in Heavenly Creatures. I'm not saying she didn't do great work before Titanic, but what did you guys think of her performance in this?
Oh, I think she's phenomenal. I think she's phenomenal. I think she's very, you know, it's so funny because I keep refusing to believe how young Kate Winslet was. You know, when she did Titanic, she was, what, 21, 22? Like, she was very young. I mean, she's playing like a 16-year-old or something like that.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
But so this period, like, she's actually very young and still trying to figure out exactly, you know, what she's doing. And this is a little bit before Hollywood really begins to value, like, youth in, you know, in its leading ladies. But, you know, the films that she does, like, they're not, I mean, Quills is a prestige movie that is in the awards race. It's not ain't chopped liver. I think it's okay. I don't think it's a great movie, but she's in Enigma, the year after which actually is really good. Like, Michael Apted's Enigma, about this, you know, about the, well, the Enigma, about Bletchley Park and all that. Which I actually really, I remember really enjoying that film. So, you know, they're like, she's doing real movies. I mean, you know, Life of David Gale is lousy, but, you know, I mean, at the time, I'm sure it seemed like, you know, a no brainer, you know.
It was a bad moment when we were making movies like The Life of David Gale. Yeah, but, look, I hesitate to say this because it's such lame analysis, but everything she did between Titanic and Eternal Sunshine just looks boring on a poster. And I really don't know if a lot of them are boring, but I know a lot of them are period. A lot of them are British. A lot of them are with directors like Michael Apted, who's a great director, but not not a Michel Gondry, not a, iconoclast. And I think that there was something that kind of happened around Eternal Sunshine where she started working with different kinds of directors. They didn't all work, but different kinds of directors who were making different kinds of movies that I think expanded what the public expected from a Kate Winslet film, where before it felt very narrow, a movie more or less outside of Titanic, which is, you know, obviously a period piece as well, you know, a movie set outside of America, a movie that's, you know, somewhat humorless, a movie that's somewhat somewhat staid and maybe a costume drama or something along those lines. Sure. But Eternal Sunshine, at least for me, felt like, oh, she could do anything.
I agree. You know?
Oh, I didn't realize that. I didn't realize that she went that far in that direction. Because then I love her in Steve Jobs. I think she's so good in that movie. And obviously, I think she was incredible in Mare of Easttown. Like, yeah. She can go in any direction. And I don't think that, you know, I understood that until that film.
I was going to extend the Mark Ruffalo bit and ask you what it was like to work with her in Eternal Sunshine, but...
Oh, yes, you were in that.
Yeah.
You were great, too.
Loved it.
Love you dancing.
Love Michelle. Love great. just really adored working with Michelle.
Did he actually even cross with Kate Winslet in that movie?
He's with the lab rats,
Kirsten
right?
Dunst. He's with Elijah Wood and Kirsten
Dunst. Oh, right,
yeah. Elijah Wood crossed with her.
The thing is, though, I mean, if you look at Kate Winslet's career, like, she has these like moments of just, you know, brilliance. And then she'll do a bunch of films that just seem to go nowhere or, you know, just seem like middling Oscar Beatty type movies. And, you know, I mean, these are, who knows what goes into these things. You know, some of these projects I'm sure look great on paper. She does them. Or maybe she loved, you know, there might be movies she loved. I mean, look, I mean, people ding The Reader, but she won her Oscar for it. One presumes that she wanted to do that movie.
I never saw The Reader.
I mean, like Revolutionary Road, I really like.
It's a good movie.
And a lot of people don't. And actually, that's like the one, you know, it's like the one Sam Mendes movie I actually like.
Don't you think that's about the reunion, though? That was like people were like, Kate and Leo are back together and this is what we got.
Miserable.
Yeah, it was awesome. That's the best part about it.
I know, I agree.
But yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people were turned off because, you know, I've never read the novel and apparently, you know, it only adapts one part of the novel. And I think people were a little like that was not the movie they had in their head of that novel. I can't speak to that, but I just remember watching it and being really, really kind of blown away and deeply moved by it. The period stuff she was doing before Titanic, like Jude is fantastic.
Jude's a really good movie. Yeah.
And Hamlet is actually like Branagh's masterpiece. Yeah. Yeah. A great Ophelia. Sense and Sensibility obviously is great.
Heavenly Creatures is amazing. Yeah. And
I think she's always kind of been trying to do different things. And part of the problem with that is that sometimes they don't hit, you know?
I also think it's worth saying too, that like, I do think that the post-Titanic headspace must have been a real mindfuck, right? Like, there's all that talk about how Leonardo DiCaprio wanted to do American Psycho and had to be literally talked out of doing it. By the way, I don't think he would have been a particularly great Patrick Bateman, but that's kind of neither here nor there. Like, they both were just like, I don't want to be put in a box and I don't want to be a gigantic, quote-unquote, movie star right now. I want to do weird shit. Yeah. And it took them some time, both of them, to kind of get their sea legs and figure out what it meant to be who they wanted to be after that.
Was Leo? Leo's first. Well, I. What's that? No, the beach. The beach, of course, is to me as crazy as doing an American as American Psycho.
It's a pretty.
But his first movie after Titanic is
Celebrity,
A Man in the Iron Mask.
I think he
made it before the movie came out. Yeah. But I remember Man in the Iron Mask, one of the worst films ever.
Of course, terrible film.
But like famously, like I believe it was maybe the movie that dethroned Titanic at the box office.
Yes, they were one and two.
After Titanic, it made like $800 million. Like, sure. Man of the Iron Man.
I think the Leo, you know, Leo went directly to the best in the game.
Yeah.
You know, just directly to the best in the game over and over and over again. And people who never worked with people in his generation, Spielberg and Scorsese, basically said, I'm going to be your guy as long as you want me to be your guy. I don't know if there was a lane or an opportunity for Kate to do that.
And that's exactly, I mean, that's when we talk about like women in the film industry, that's something you really have to, because guys are able to, I mean, if you're top of the top, if you're like, you know, if you've just gotten off the biggest hit of all time and you're a 20 something male actor, Spielberg has a part for you. Scorsese, all these guys, like Michael Mann has a part for you. All these people have parts for you. And if you're a woman in that position,
yeah,
not like those guys don't necessarily have parts for you. They might. And there might be some other filmmakers who have parts for you, but like, and Leo, I mean, Leo, I think Leo also has a really good, like just a taste meter for being able to pick good projects, but he also like, he was able to just like latch onto Scorsese and just be like Scorsese's guy, over the course. And it was a symbiotic relationship, right? Because having Leo allowed Scorsese to get these movies made because he wasn't necessarily, you know, he wasn't necessarily box office gold himself, but like Leo attaching himself to Scorsese also, you know, burnished his credentials, and they, you know, they did great work.
But there
wasn't somebody like that for Kate Winslet to to attach.
Which is why I think Jane Campion is so enticing, right? Like that's why you're like, I'm going to jump in the Jane Campion movie for sure. Sorry,
I agree with you. No, I agree. But I'm thinking about the people who do kind of pluck these younger female stars and try to make them their person, and they tend to be like super creeps. Like Woody did it with Scarlett Johansson.
Sure.
And David O. Russell did it with Jennifer Lawrence.
Yep.
So it this thing happens.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say Noah Baumbach and Greta Gerwig is a super creep situation, but also that.
Sure.
And you know, who knows what that situation is? But you don't, to the point we're making, you don't have the top five make whatever you want filmmakers eat on the commercial side. Or on the critical side, or where those two things meet, who are doing that? That just isn't a thing, and that is not necessarily a big problem, but that is a big hurdle
for sure. As we wrap this up, I just want to kind of talk about the end of the movie for a quick second here. We have sort of this moment where PJ writes "Be kind" on Ruth's forehead, and it sort of sends her reeling a little bit. And they kind of get into this physical altercation where he punches her in the face and knocks her unconscious. And then he puts her in the trunk and he pretends that she's run away. And there's this whole sort of like, it gets real kind of nutty and very sort of physical in a way that I don't necessarily know that I associate with Jane Campion. Like, it gets a little bit like you're unsure. Like, it's not played for jokes, obviously. Like, he punches her in the face and like she's legitimately scared for her life. And there's all this sort of stuff going on. But there's also this kind of like wackiness to it that it's a bit of a tonal gamble, I guess is the best way to put it. What did you guys think about sort of how the film resolved itself?
For me, by that point, the film is so kind of unhinged that I was like, all right, he punched her in the face. I mean, not to make light of it, but like the thing I was talking about of just like the tonal shifts constantly, you know, and I tend to be someone who doesn't love tonal shifts in movies. I mean, I love tonal shifts in movies when they're done the right way.
Sure.
But I don't love movies where the tone seems to be all over the place. Mm-hmm. But here's a case where it actually works for me because like that's kind of the movie's thing, is that the tone is constantly changing. So like it made perfect sense that it got real dark there. And then also like he stashes her in the trunk. I was like, wait, does he think she's like dead? Like what? Like it's kind of a weird. And then, you know, and then the confrontation with the family, and then the family saves her.
Yep.
You know, her asshole family saves her. Like, I mean, but at this point, you know, this is full. I mean, like we talked about the messiness of like, this is full on like, oh yeah, no. When we say the messiness of life, we mean it. Like, you know, like everything is just out of control at this point. And I think, and I can imagine that, you know, Jane Campion has, I mean, she's a filmmaker who has plenty of like dashes of humor in her films, but she's not really a comedy filmmaker. And maybe, you know, it's possible that this was her attempt to kind of build up just sort of a zany head of steam so that everything is kind of reaching a fever pitch and we're kind of climaxing with just, you know, all sorts of farcical nonsense happening. And maybe she just, you know, maybe she just wasn't quite like deft enough with comedy to make that work in that way. So instead it just feels like this weird movie that just gets weirder and weirder and weirder.
Just to be clear, it worked for me. I didn't dislike it. It was a little jarring. I guess I didn't really love the actual like him punching her in the face component.
I think there's a reason that she did it. I mean, you know, look, I watched piano in anticipation of this as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the piano is, about a woman who I think is constantly living under the threat of physical violence until finally she gets her fucking finger chopped off.
Yeah,
right. And I think that there's a thread there, which is no matter how smart you are or how sexually attractive you are, manipulative you are, if you're a woman and you're in a relationship with a man, there is this threat of physical violence, both because men are bigger and men are dumber. When he is being broken down to his base elements, all he is left is his, physical size. All he has left is his history of violence, so to speak.
Yeah.
And at that moment to punch her, I think is exactly I want to be delicate about this because I don't think this is true for all men, but I think that's what a typical man might do in that situation when he has been so emasculated over the course of several days.
Yeah. Well, also if everything relating to his identity has basically been stripped of him, and you see this visually too, because at this point he's wearing the dress, right? And he's got nothing on underneath, we've seen Keitel fully naked earlier in the movie, but you kind of, with the dress, you actually get a real sense of just how just stacked he is, just how like his physique, in some weird way, the dress actually, I guess that's what dresses are supposed to do. It accentuates his physique in a way that even like a shot of him completely naked didn't.
Yeah.
That's
true.
And like, that's a kind of a visual correlative for the thing you're talking about, Kenny, which is like, he's been reduced to this point.
Yeah.
At this point, that's all he is. But also like, the fact is, when you do this to somebody, you are kind of playing with fire in a sense. And at this point, she's, this is kind of like, I agree that in some weird way, it makes sense that this is what would happen. Although it is also played as like a weird moment of slapstick too. It doesn't feel like it's very menacing and threatening once it happens. But before it happens, it doesn't quite feel like,
Just this, it felt to me like a male filmmaker would have handled that differently or would have excised it. And I think I would have excised it because I want to believe that the guy wouldn't do that.
Right.
But I'm confident that a female filmmaker, I think the proof is in the movie, doesn't feel that way. I think that there is this, and the piano really, you're watching the piano really hammer this home for me. This idea of, this woman who literally doesn't have a voice and is she's literally the property of one of these men.
Yeah.
And essentially enslaved. And I think that's, I think that's a little, what's the word? A little simulacrum for what women deal with in general. And I think that, I think that direct line to what we just watched in Holy Smoke, which I don't get the title, but regardless.
I do want to, this all leads Kenny's to really...
Kinky was taken.
That's a better title.
I do want to just highlight one quick thing, that this all leads to a really interesting moment, which is basically they're all saved by, as you mentioned, Boga, her asshole family, essentially. Mm. And they put Harvey Keitel in the bed of the pickup truck. And Kate Winslet crawls into the back of the truck with him and sort of cradles him and sort of has this moment. The reason I wanted to highlight is because I've seen this image in a couple of Jane's films where a man is lying in the lap of a woman, and there's this sort of interesting, I don't want to say power dynamic, but the visual of a man being sort of cradled or being held, and sort of the woman sort of visually seeming more, I don't want to say, what I'm saying, not powerful is the wrong word, but you know what I'm getting at. There's something there. It's in Bright Star. I felt it in the piano. Like, you do feel
it's in Portrait of a Lady. It's
in Portrait of a Lady.
Incredibly beautiful moment in Portrait of a Lady.
So I think there's
Chile. Did you say Chile?
He's watching.
Gobble, gobble.
We're watching Razzie movies for another podcast.
Oh, okay,
but I do think that I think that obviously feels like an image that's very powerful to her, to Jane, and seeing that kind of dynamic.
And I think, it is very powerful, but it's also like, I don't think of it as a power dynamic thing. I feel it as a moment of tenderness. And very often in these films, it feels like a real release. And I think these, you know, and I think a lot of these, I mean, a lot of these male characters are so vulnerable. But like, I mean, the scene I'm thinking of in Portrait of a Lady just like wipes the floor with me every time I see it. And so it doesn't feel like it's a questioning of power dynamics or anything like that. It really feels like it, like whenever it happens, it feels totally right.
Yeah.
Like it feels like the whole movie has been kind of built in all of her films. It feels like the movie has just been building up to this moment. And it's so tender and beautiful that it's like, whenever that happens, it's like almost the heart of the movie in some people. I think Portrait of a Lady,
I think it's interesting you say that because I watched the piano's Oscar wins, the clips of them last night. And Jane's speech, which is great, but she highlights something really interesting where she thanks Sam Neill and Harvey Keitel for playing such complex and emotionally vulnerable men. Like it's just really interesting to me how important that is to her. And just, you know, to bring it full circle, it does feel like masculinity and that deconstruction of it and showing, you know, the spectrum that can exist in men and that they don't need to be very binary. I think it's just is a wonderful trait of hers.
Really looking forward to Power of the Dog. I'm going to watch
it. It's so good.
It's great. I mean, it's great. In some ways, it's like one of the most unforgiving movies she's ever made. But it's so good. Are you going to be able to see it on a big screen or
maybe 48-incher?
Okay, all right.
I did get a chance to see it with a Q&A with Kimberly Pierce and Jane Campion at a Guild screening. Uh-huh. And just to quickly wrap this up, I want to just talk about Jane Campion talked a little bit about her process a little bit and just how being a director, people don't talk about it enough as being a failure all the time. And she just talked about how 90% of the footage we shoot is thrown away. Think about that for a second. And it really just, I love that she goes into it that way, knowing that most of this stuff is going to be thrown away. I think that's kind of great.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think filmmakers, I would imagine, you know, I mean, you guys can speak to this even better, but, you know, like it's all about, I mean, that's the thing. It's, and I think a lot of artists do this, and it's sometimes hard for people who think about becoming artists or trying to imagine the life of an artist. They don't realize it. Like when the thing that always blows my mind is like how much a photographer shoots. Yeah. Right. Because, like I'll take a picture and I'll go, oh man, that sucks. I did a terrible job with that picture. And then I realize, an actual photographer would take like 600 fucking shots before they got the right picture. Yeah. And like much of it is just the patience and like the mental fortitude to allow yourself to just make mistakes over and over and over and over and over again until
nobody gets that.
You get it right. And then sometimes you don't even know you got it right until later. And then you're like, all right, that's like, that was the Kubrick thing where he'd do 80 takes and like take two.
Sure. I mean, how many drafts do we do?
Writing is rewriting. Not even how many drafts. I mean, you know, how many fucking scenes do I write that I throw away? How many, 180 page drafts do I write that need to be 60?
It's all about killing your babies. It's brutal. Yeah. So at the end of every episode, Bilge, we do a rating system, 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, 99 being the highest. And we rate it before we do the podcast and after to see whether or not the conversation changed our opinions in one way or another. Okay. So I'll go first.
This is like the Oxford debate thing, right?
Yeah. So I hadn't seen this film in 99, as I mentioned. I really liked this movie. I think I'm at around a 70. I think it's maybe even a little higher. It might be at a 75 now after this conversation, because I do feel like this film doesn't totally exist. Like, I'm not sure that a lot of people even know about this movie, and more people should, and hopefully this podcast will help more people seek it out. But I got to tell you, like, I mean, you're a critic, Bilge, but like 46% from critics, obviously it's 1999, it's a different time, there's any number of things, but how you could watch this movie and not think that it was worthy of being above at least 50% seems absolutely crazy to me, but yeah.
I can never take like Rotten Tomatoes score. Is that a Rotten Tomatoes score?
Or
Metacritic? I can never take those scores seriously because, you know, somebody can write a mixed review that acknowledges, you know, like that there are great things about a movie, but that certain things don't work. And you know, somebody at Rotten Tomatoes has to say, oh, is that a pro or con? You know, like,
yeah, I mean, take it all with a grain of salt, obviously.
That's tough. So I can't go by that because every time I've looked into that, unless it's a movie that just completely flopped, every time I've looked into that and like actually read the reviews, I'm like, well, that's a perfectly interesting, good review that, you know, like, yeah, maybe it's ultimately a con, but, you know, it's not really a con, you know? I mean, because that's the thing I try to do in my reviews. I don't always succeed at this, but like, even if it's a film I didn't like, I try to give enough of a sense of the film so that someone can read the review. And even though I maybe wasn't like crazy about the film, that they can actually read my review and think, oh, that seems like something I should see, because that used to happen to me. I mean, I grew up in DC where Rita Kempley was the Washington Post film critic. And, you know, she was not a good critic. Or that's not fair.
Okay.
She was not a critic I agreed with.
Okay. Fair
but
enough.
She often gave enough of a sense in her reviews of the films that there's so many films I saw. I read the review. I was like, well, this seems like something I should see. And then I'd see it. I'd be like, well, she was wrong. It's great. But at the same time, I got to give credit to her for leading me to the film. So,
so putting the Rotten Tomatoes score aside, where do you land on this film? What did you think of it when you saw it back in the day? And do you feel like your perspective and your number has changed, or where would you lie on?
I saw it. I didn't see it in 99. I saw it like a year or so later when it came out on, I think it would have been DVD, the early years of DVD. Mm-hmm. I like rented it from my local video store. And it didn't make much of an impact on me. And I will say at this point, I'm not entirely sure if I'm talking about Holy Smoke or Hideous Kinky. Like, I think literally, I think I might have rented them both like the same week. No, I wasn't like a huge fan of it at the time. I think for me, it'd be like a 70, mm-hmm. 75. Okay. I mean, it's one of those films. Look, a director like Jane Campion, you always like a lesser effort from her is more interesting than,
of course,
look, that's more interesting than the best thing Sam Mendes ever did, you know, which is actually Revolutionary Road starred Kate Winslet. But you know, so, So anyway,
I love all this shade at Sam Mendes.
I'm sorry. I don't know why I've suddenly fixated on Sam Mendes.
I can't believe you came on the 99 podcast where all we do is talk about how much we love American Beauty.
right. That's why, because I think I was thinking because I had 99 on the brain.
We do not like American Beauty.
One of the great crimes of history.
To beat the insider is just, you know,
just the best one nominated.
Yeah. That whole Oscars lineup is just an absolute fucking catastrophe.
Kenny, where are you? What's your rating on this?
I was actually 58 before the podcast, for all the reasons I kind of said right in the beginning. I'm higher now. I mean, it leaves a far better impression. I think the conversation has, illuminated some elements I didn't really think were weren't front of mind right after the film, but are now. And I'm going to go up to 68 because I will not make a stupid joke.
Great. There you go.
68.
Bilge, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us about this. This was, I mean, we are, Kenny and I are huge fans of your work.
Yes,
we love your work.
Thank you.
Please, everyone should be following Bilge on Twitter. What is your handle, Bilge?
Bilge Abiri, at Bilge Abiri. If you can spell it, can you find me?
if you can spell it, you can find him.
For all the hottest Nets goss. When is Kyrie finally going to take a shot? I think we know the answer to that.
Yeah, I think Kyrie's probably going to wind up getting traded at some point. But
we're huge fans, and we're so thankful to be able to talk about Jane Campion with you, and we hope that you'll come back in the future.
I would love to.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening. Podcast Like It. You want a podcast like it. 1999.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.